Kick it! KBOO is a proud sponsor of the 4th Portland Renters Assembly and their March for Housing Rights. The assembly is on August 26th at the Midland Library from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. There will be speakers on the housing crisis and community organizing, personal stories, large and small group discussion about political strategy, but also defending and otherwise supporting each other. Snacks and childcare will be provided. The march is on August 28th. It starts at City Hall at 6 p.m. with a rally and ends at the Multnomah County Building with another assembly. The theme will be Housing Rights for All and will encompass everything from homelessness to affordable housing to tenants' rights to at-cost public housing. More information can be found at kboo.fm under Community Events or portlandrentersassembly.info.
You gotta fight for your right!
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the African Hip Hop Caravan Benefit Show, August 29th, from 3 to 6 p.m. at Columbia International Cup in Portland. All ages are welcome to this benefit show, featuring Mike Crenshaw and Rashid Jamal, to raise funds and awareness for their November trip to various countries in Africa. Again, that's a benefit show for the African Hip Hop Caravan on Saturday, August 29th, from 3 to 6 p.m. at Columbia International Cup, 9022 North Newman Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Peace.
It's the HIP to the HOP, it's the movement. Hip Hop Caravan is the HIP to the HOP, it's the movement. Hip Hop Caravan.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland and the Old Mole Variety Hour. We bring you news, reviews, and commentary grounded in the struggles of everyday people and guided by the idea that a better world is possible. Well, a better world may indeed be necessary if it is to remain habitable for future generations. Bill Resnick starts out the show today with a discussion of how to teach our children well about in lessons about the climate crisis. Bill interviews Bill Bigelow and Tim Swinehart on their new book, A People's Curriculum for the Earth, a project focused on teaching about the environmental crisis and climate justice. I'll be talking with Katie Gentile about the controversy of the sale of fetal tissue at Planned Parenthood clinics and what this controversy is really about. Gentile is professor of interdisciplinary studies and gender studies at John Jay College of Criminal Justice and has written extensively on reproductive technologies. Later in the hour, our newest member of the Old Mole Collective, Desiree Helligers, brings a report from Portland's Cathedral Park, where activists on July 30th successfully delayed the transit of Shell Oil's icebreaker on its way up to the Arctic. The segment features the voice of Greenpeace climber Marty Anyado, founder and director of the Indigenous People's Power Project. Concluding our show today, Old Mole's radical reader, Larry Bolden, reviews the book Balls by Nancy Kincaid, a novel about, well, what else? College football, told from the perspectives of women. I'm Jan Hawken, and Joe Clement today is engineering. Now, here is Bill Resnick talking with Bill Bigelow and Tom Swinehart about A People's Curriculum for the Earth.
Bill Bigelow and Tim Swinehart, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. It's good to be back on the venerable Old Mole.
Bill Bigelow taught for 30 years at Jefferson and Franklin High Schools, also at Portland State University's School of Education. He's an editor of Rethinking Schools, concentrating on innovative and engaging curriculums. He's written hundreds of articles, and how many books, Bill, are you now taking credit for?
Oh, I'm not taking credit for any, and not counting either. Plenty.
It's 6 to 8 at least.
Yeah, somewhere in there.
There's probably more that don't get listed in your bio.
I'll take your word for it, Bill.
One of the books is Stranger in Their Own Country, a curriculum on South Africa. It's also Rethinking Columbus, Rethinking Globalization, and a history on work and workers entitled Power in Our Hands. His latest book, A People's Curriculum for the Earth, was written and edited with Tim Swinehart, who now teaches at Lincoln High School and at Lewis and Clark College's the master's degree program in education at Lewis and Clark College. And he's active in Portland Rethinking Schools. So, Bill and Tim, why did you decide to write A People's Curriculum for the Earth?
Good question, Bill, and I'm not sure that we would have had we known it would last for 8 years or so. But we began, I think, and Tim can correct me anything I say that's wrong, but I think we began when we saw and were horrified by what Portland Public Schools had adopted as the Global Studies textbook in 2007. Students in Portland take only one class in their high school career on the world. And what Portland Public Schools had adopted is a textbook called Modern World History. And there were three paragraphs on global warming buried on page 679. And the second paragraph begins, "Not all scientists agree with the theory of the greenhouse effect." It's not that we thought we had such hopes for what the textbook would be about, but we just knew that we needed to have some kind of alternative to what students were going to be getting.
Yeah, and I guess maybe one other piece of the story is that we went back to Washington, D.C. together to go to a teach-in sponsored by the International Forum on Globalization. And it was a wonderful event, and there were a lot of really inspiring speakers, Bill McKibben, Annie Leonard, that does the story of stuff, Michael Clare. And it was just like 3 days of on the triple crisis of the climate crisis. But we came away realizing that even as kind of the left was approaching this issue of the climate crisis, the environmental crisis, that they weren't talking about education. And if they were talking about college-level education. So it felt like there was this big gap in the K-12 education in terms of dealing with the climate crisis in a way that was really kind of meaningful and trying to engage students in a real critical way.
Well, so it was that moment, I suppose, when with all those ideas in the air at the, what was it called?
It was called the Triple Crisis. It was the International Forum on Globalization. It focused on climate change as well as energy depletion.
I suppose with all of that in the air, and you've written so many curriculums that you've written, well, you work on curriculums in your class. You've always been interested in really innovative, sort of engaging, get kids involved in the world. So, you went together, and then the idea of actually producing a book on climate change and other environmental dangers. Climate change is not the only one, although it is the most immediate and the most dangerous for, it seems to me, for life on Earth.
But, we should clarify that Tim and I never had the idea that we were going to do this as the two of us.
Absolutely.
That in the case of Rethinking Globalization that I did with Bob Peterson back in 2002, it actually began in 1997, with the call to teachers throughout Portland who were teaching about globalization and wanted to teach about globalization to come together and develop curriculum. And in this case, it was the same thing. We knew that we wanted to address the environmental crisis, and we knew that we couldn't do it ourselves, and that we wanted to pull together some of the best teachers that we knew in Portland and to workshop curriculum and critique together and to produce.
Not to jump too far ahead, but I think that there's a message in the method as well, and in that one of the things that we really stress in the teaching that grew out of this book and the introduction to the book is that there are no individual solutions to the climate crisis. The case is true for this sort of teaching as well. There's no way to do this by yourself. The issues are too huge. Teachers are too loaded up with the increasing levels of responsibilities these days. And so you can't take this sort of thing on yourself. And so the collaboration, the community that grew out of this, I think, is a message for how we have to approach the climate crisis as well.
Good schools, I read something recently, what really characterizes a good school, the argument of this thing, was not having a bully principal and having a principal who wants their teachers to collaborate, which they all want to do, on having a curriculum where kids keep building on knowledge and being able to use knowledge and use the distinctions that they've learned. The book, it seems to me, really lends itself to that. I was interested in... Bill, you said we don't expect our book to be adopted in place of the current global studies text. It seems to me that your confident teachers can, and in fact, the general public should read it too. It's really very interesting. We'll get to that near the end, how adult study groups have used thousands of copies a year of some of your work, like Rethinking Globalization, is being used by church study groups and many others. That's a great achievement. I hadn't realized that before. But for teachers... It seems to me they can use pieces. All of your curriculums that I've seen are structured so that you can take out pieces and lessons, and you ask teachers within to elaborate on them and use your own local materials, and you're invited to use them as you see fit to make a more engaging curriculum.
I think I can use big pieces, yeah. And I guess I sort of see this as a Rethinking Columbus moment, that when we did Rethinking Columbus back in 1991, what passed as curriculum on Columbus then was Columbus Discovers America, and isn't it a great thing? And the gap...
In the most naive and sort of superficial and sort of patriotic, white patriotic...
Well, way, and racist, because of whose perspectives were not being told and the silences in the curriculum. But I think the same thing is true now. I think that with the climate crisis, here is a crisis we don't even have a language for. The breadth of this, what is happening to the world... is just so indescribable. And yet the silence in the curriculum is just deafening. And this textbook is a great example. This is the textbook still in here in Green, Portland, three paragraphs on the climate crisis, and they're wretched paragraphs. And so the gap between what we need to be doing and the curriculum available is just immense.
This is KBOO Radio, Bill Resnick for The Old Mole, talking to Bill Bigelow, who was taught in Portland schools and Portland State University for 30 years. He's now continuing as an editor and concentrating on curriculums for Rethinking Schools. And Tim Swinehart, who teaches at Lincoln High School right now and is also at Lewis and Clark. One of the things that struck me, and Bill Bigelow was just talking about that this is a time where the message of global warming is so poorly taught in the schools and everywhere, and yet people are becoming more concerned that the ideas in this book really are on people's minds and will likely, in a not-too-distant future, it seems to me, become a dominant issue in American life that touches everybody. In fact, in this book, I've read almost all of it, you really name capitalism, I mean, in a way that doesn't just, it's not a slur, it's right. An explanation of how this economic system works and why it's inconsistent with the habitability for humans of the planet.
Yeah, and actually that's kind of a great lead-in. I wanted to mention, because I hear my science colleagues talking in one ear, I do think that there are teachers, probably even at the grade school level, but certainly in the middle school level and the high school level, that are doing some great science education when it comes to global warming, climate change, and even the environmental crisis. But I think another gap that we recognized was that it's one thing to teach kids about carbon dioxide and about melting glaciers and about maybe even in a biology class about the effects on ecosystems and certain species. It's an entirely different thing to ask them to think about the way in which climate change and this whole environmental crisis connects to our economic system, to our social structures, to inequality in the world. And so I think that those are things that we really, through the role plays and the simulations and the readings in this book, that we really try to make this, we make it about people, we make it about injustice, and the way in which, for example, the climate crisis has this inherent injustice, right, where the people who are least responsible for causing it around the world are often and usually the most affected by the effects of climate change. And so bringing a lot of those issues home to students in a way that they're not just intellectualizing, but they're feeling it in their hearts. And it's a moral issue, is something very different from teaching the science of climate change.
And they feel it in their lives as well, because a lot of these kids, most families now in Portland, are recycling in one way or another, and they become sort of militant about it. Another piece of your book, I mean, there's so many important sort of ideas that are embedded in it in a vivid way. And one of them, of course, is the limitations of just individual action. Maybe you can talk about how you do that.
One of the things, too, that I've noticed teaching about this over the years is that you meet students where they're at when they come into the class, and that there's sort of a journey, I think, to take with them when it comes to these issues. And I think that in Portland that you know, there are a lot of students that come in caring deeply about recycling and composting and riding their bikes and
which is all good. It's great.
Yeah,
because it's an introduction and they're doing it in their lives.
Yeah, on so many different levels.
Yeah.
It's important, and it's definitely something that, to the extent that we all have the ability to do that we should be. But there are important limitations there. And so, you know, when we're asking them to think about capitalism, to think about systems, there's this disconnect between the idea that we have an entire economic system that is trashing people and trashing the planet, and then the solutions to that kids are often taught in school have to do with changing your light bulbs and taking shorter showers. Individual solutions, and it was kind of a powerful moment, but I just a few weeks ago I had a kid, after a student in class, we'd read a piece in the book called Forget Shorter Showers, which kind of brings up this issue about the inadequacies of purely individual responses to these crises. And he said, I feel like I've been lied to my whole life. This is what I've been told by teachers and society, that this is how I respond to this crisis.
You know, one of the things too, we don't just want to give kids readings or present just, here, read this tract that is an alternative to your textbook tract. We try and do it through games and through role plays and through activities. One of the activities I think that brings this to life is called The Mystery of the Three Scary Numbers. And it's based on Bill McKibben's article, Global Warming's Terrifying New Math, that was in Rolling Stone. And students encounter the three scary numbers, that the world agrees that we can't go beyond 2 degrees Celsius of heating. There's a budget. There's a carbon budget. It's 565 gigatons of carbon. And yet the fossil fuel industry, along with countries that act like the fossil fuel industry, have 2,795 gigatons of carbon ready to burn that is growing. And so you see that, well, wait a second. If we are on this horrific collision course here, it really doesn't make a difference to recycle. It doesn't make a difference to just kind of cut back, because the people who are making these decisions, who own this carbon, they really don't care. And that, so it has to be the patterns of decision making need to be confronted if ultimately we stand a chance of survival.
Right. And the way they're confronted, you also, it seems to me, there are these stories you tell and pieces you have on, for example, La Via Campesino, probably the biggest.
Well, arguably the biggest social movement in the
right.
world, with more than 200 million people in organizations in, 174 different organizations in 64 countries.
Including the United States, who have an affiliate.
Mm-hmm. And good luck finding it in the textbook.
Right. But they really are taking on cash crop industrial agriculture. And you have I thought one of the more interesting things, I learned a lot from it, was the comparison. You talked about the posed agricultural policies of the G7, that is the big seven industrial states, although I think Russia's been dropped from it now.
Well, Russia, it was G8 when Russia was around. Yeah.
G8. Now, right.
Now it's G7. Yeah.
Oh, you're really up with the topic.
We are, Bill,
right.
Always.
The great G7, you contrast these two policies and the way in which the La Via Campesino is taking them on and presenting an alternative. Really important to present alternatives and not tell people you just have to leave a bleak life in order to not use any energy nor eat any food that you might like and cut back in every conceivable way. That's not the case. In fact, Via Campesino assures us that they could feed the world with a very different kind of agriculture, which most agricultural scientists now agree is possible.
We want a pedagogy that brings that to life. So instead of just telling kids about La Via Campesina, what Tim and Chris Bueller and Julie Trike O'Neill and I developed was a role play to try and bring that to life. And so, as you say, the kind of the conceit or the structure of the role play is that Livia Campesina is going to a G7 meeting in The Hague, where the G7 is proposing a plan to feed the world. And of course, it's this elaborate neoliberal free trade plan.
Take over land that's not being used properly and productively by small-scale agriculturalists, basically kill them, force them into the big cities, and then run their huge plantations using fossil fuels, pesticides, and
right. And so students learn about this.
Yeah.
Students learn about this by becoming constituent members of La Via Campesina, the Basque Peasant Union from the Basque Country, and the Peasant Union of Mozambique, and the Tamil Nadu Women's Collective.
And Brazil and Mexico, huge.
Exactly, the MST Brazil. And so groups, they become, they try to become, they experience, they enter in into the persona of these groups, they meet each other in a mixer fashion, and then they come not to participate because they haven't been invited by the G7, but in the slogan of La Via Campesina, no negotiation without mobilization. And so they come to demonstrate. And so kids in class develop signs and slogans and placards, you know, the Peasant Union of Mozambique, food for the many, not for the money, and with elaborate displays. And so they actually kind of simulate the organizing and they get kind of this classroom dose of the solidarity and movement.
And learn La Via Campesina, they do work with their own members and the periphery and their families to develop their understanding of their position in the world and how their lives are imperiled and how they can, in fact, maintain themselves. I mean, it has a truly sort of intellectual and educative operation.
Yeah, and I think there's this really interesting way, too, in which a lot of these groups, the MST, the Landless Peasants of Brazil, are a great example where you have groups of people, again, that are being impacted right now by the climate crisis, right? So instead of the rains that generations of farmers in, say, the northeast of Brazil, the sort of the seasonal rains that they would count on, they're more sporadic. And when they come all at once, right? And so they, you know, they're using these agroecology methods. And this is stuff that you would probably normally study in like a graduate level agricultural science class or something, right? But we have high school kids that are actually getting into this and they're kind of excited about it. And they say, wow, this is cool. You know, these farmers they're developing these new methods. It's a form of technology. It's adaptation to climate change. And they're doing it in a way that feeds their community and is working for greater justice in the world. And it's this whole picture. It's the whole package.
We want kids to see and explore that explicitly, to see that if you deal radically and deeply with the issue of food, that you're also dealing with climate. You're also dealing with public health. You're dealing with forced migration. You're dealing with a host of issues that are all connected, and you don't have to deal with them separately. If you deal with one thing radically, you deal with them all.
One final thing, Tim Swinehart, Bill Bigelow, your book, A People's Curriculum for the Earth, it's for schools, and it can go all the way into college. You get a lot of people, I think, college teachers who have more room. Teachers do have some room and have preserved themselves, especially in Portland, to use your book and many other books. And that's part of the fight now over education is canned curriculums. But the people who really have complete room, of course, are adult study groups and all of us to educate ourselves through the book. How do we get it?
Get it from rethinkingschools.org is the best place to get it. Don't buy it from Amazon. No, I think you're right, Bill. I think it's good for all those folks. And I think that there's a whole movement of teachers trying to, you know, teach outside the textbook. The Zinn Education Project that I co-direct, we just hit 50,000 people who have registered to download free teaching outside the textbook materials. And so there's really a great openness, I think, to this kind of curriculum, particularly because so much of the official curriculum, like ours here in Portland, is controlled by giant corporations who have no interest whatsoever in kids thinking critically and raising questions, particularly the ones that Tim was talking about capitalism.
Yeah, how much better a classroom is when kids are engaged than when they're bored and fighting you and reading junk.
Well, that's it. It's more fun to teach. Yeah.
Great talking to you today. Thanks a lot, Tim Swinehart and Bill Bigelow.
Thanks, Bill.
Now, normally, if I can help it, I don't spend a lot of time in a principal's office.
What? Huh. 9 o'clock.
I got this week. So to my first class, I run and don't walk. All I hear is my sneakers and the scratching of chalk. And when I get to the room, I hear the teacher say, Mr. Young, I'm happy that you could join us today. I try to sit down so I can take some notes, but I can't read what the kid next to me wrote. And if that wasn't enough to make my morning complete, as I try to get up, I find his gum on my seat. And with the seat stuck to me, I raise my hand and say, excuse me, but can I go to the bathroom, ma'am? The teacher got upset and she screamed out, no, it's off to the principal's office you go.
That was Principal's Office by Young MC. You are listening to KBOO Portland and the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Jan Hawken, and next on the show, I talk with Katie Gentile, a professor of gender studies at John Jay College, about the recent crisis at Planned Parenthood clinics. Welcome to KBOO, Katie.
Hi, Jan.
Well, just for those who have not followed this story, the group at the center of the drama, an anti-abortion group, sent several people pretending to be fetal tissue brokers as they surreptitiously video recorded a Planned Parenthood official negotiating with them about the sale of fetal tissue from abortions. The videos released in July have generated a steady stream of moral outrage and condemnation of Planned Parenthood for what these anti-abortion advocates describe as the cold-hearted selling of baby parts. And I think it's worth noting this is one of those rare media moments when conservatives express outrage over the profit motive. Katie Gentile, you have written extensively on reproductive politics and new technologies and what you have described as the fetishizing of the fetus in popular culture. And this very well may be a case example. But before explaining that term, the fetishizing of the fetus, to us, what's your take on this drama and particularly the accusations hurled at Planned Parenthood, including this accusation that they're selling baby parts for profits?
Well, I think you described it well in terms of the fetish, but I think that, well, Planned Parenthood is under attack in general, as we know, and I think they will do, I think the people who want to shut them down are stopping at nothing, including this weird kind of entrapment where what Planned Parenthood is doing is legal, but people don't like to think about it for many different reasons. The idea that fetal tissue is used in medical research. And it's used in medical research in ways that have helped a lot of people. I mean, it's medical research. It's legal, government-funded medical research. So in that sense, it's the way they're twisting it does have to do with the squeamishness in the culture about using this the fetus, which is kind of like the epitome of a helpless, vulnerable victim.
Yeah, and before taking up the question of what fetal tissue perhaps symbolically carries in political culture for conservatives particularly, let's just talk about that whole allegation. You say that, you mentioned that it is legal to sell fetal tissue. The National Institutes of Health Revitalization Act of 1993 does allow a woman to consent to donating fetal tissue after an abortion. And fetal tissue has been used for research apparently since the 1930s, and current studies are using the tissue to research diseases like AIDS, muscular dystrophy, and Parkinson's disease. So many people have benefited from this research over the decades. But what about the issue of the allegation of selling for profits? And of course, that there's a long history of what some sociologists call moral panic over selling body parts or body organs, killing babies and harvesting their organs. Periodically, there are these kind of moral panics over commerce in baby parts. But could you first clarify what that specific allegation that the Planned Parenthood clinics are violating the law in selling these tissues for profit. What is the nature of the economic exchange?
The nature of the economic exchange, in terms of, it is completely legal. It is not legal to sell organs, but it is legal to sell fetal tissue, and that may be a sticking point for a lot of people to understand the difference. And you know, it's unclear. You know, our government has made that difference, basically. But it is legal to sell fetal tissue. In terms of profit, you know, Planned Parenthood is a non-for-profit, and they're not selling it for profit as in like they're buying jets. It's profit to keep the Planned Parenthood running.
To cover the costs involved in these services.
In services that they give to, they are the primary health provider for women's health in most of the rural places in the United States, or they were. I mean, they're pretty much the only game in town for many, many rural, you know, addresses in the United States and poor areas in the United States.
Well, so let's turn now to how these anti-abortion advocates have been able to kind of mobilize moral outrage around this issue and what that's about. What do you mean when you say there's been a fetishizing of the fetus in public discourse and popular culture? Maybe first explain what you mean by the fetish.
Sure. I mean, a fetish typically, just in general terms, is kind of used as an object of displacement. So you're displacing anxieties that may be global. It may be actually in other areas. The fetus becomes an area that's easier to be worried about, to project your anxiety on, because it is seen as kind of controllable. Much more controllable than, say, global warming, even though obviously we need to control global warming. But, you know, the idea of the fetus is a smaller, easier to digest thing that we have control over. So in that sense, and I think you can see it all over the culture. I mean, you see it in terms of the obsession with baby bumps in celebrity magazines, the obsession about women putting off childbearing too long, or, you know, the fetish of having teenage moms. In research I did in the late 90s, the big crisis over pregnancy was actually teen pregnancy. It was a problem. Now the crisis over pregnancy is that women either wait too long or aren't taking care of themselves adequately, and therefore they're criminalized.
So the anxiety, there may be something you're saying about the fetus as an early potential tissue that has the potential to become a life, a human life, that evokes this both anxiety and the impulse to protect something. But what is put out of view, what you might say repressed, is the actual source of the anxiety. So is there something about the impulse to protect that is part of this as well? To protect a part of potential life from all of the threats people experience from many directions in their world.
Yeah. Oh, no, absolutely. And the fetus, historically, and, you know, Mary Douglas, the anthropologist, talks about when social bodies are in crisis, when there is a crisis and disharmony and chaos, that oftentimes the body becomes the site of regulation. And the fetal body, it does represent the future. I mean, you know, children are the future. That's the kind of commodified hopefulness that is fed to us. And, you know, obviously it's not true. It is true. I mean, the children are the future of humanity as a species. So this idea of protecting the fetus is also, I mean, it's a displacement about anxieties of the future, but it's a great displacement in a lot of ways, because the fetus can be the embodiment of the future.
So it also seems a kind of instance of more of a moral fetish, in a way, that the conservative narrow focus on fetal tissue as tissue that is kind of potential to become alive becomes this narrow beam of moral concern, as opposed to all of the effects of the environment on people who choose to have children, who have children, and the troubles of the world for children as they enter and try to find their way in it.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that makes it stand out so much to me as a fetish is the fact that you've got the personhood amendments going through, where women are being arrested for endangering their fetus because they took drugs, because they drank, because fill in the blank things that actually, and then they're put in jail and not given prenatal care. Now, if we really were, if people were really morally outraged about the care of this fetus, when they're in jail, the women would get prenatal care. Women have been arrested for not taking prenatal vitamins, and then they go to the prison, and guess what? They don't get prenatal vitamins. So that's why when I say it's a fetish, it's a true displacement, because if we really cared about the fetus, there would be this follow-up. There would be follow-up with universal prenatal care that's accessible and not punitive if women don't do exactly what their doctor tells them to do.
So that's
and then
our,
obviously.
Yeah, and that, yeah. That's our job as feminists, is to broaden that field of vision and kind of undermine this kind of fetishizing defense that the right wing hides behind. This is Jan Hawken talking today with Katie Gentile, who has a book coming out just as we close. Katie, you have a book coming out in January, as I understand it, on reproductive technologies.
Yes, it's called The Business of Being Made, and it is an edited book. It has a number of different experts looking at NICUs, neonatal ICUs, and assisted reproductive technology at donation. It runs the gamut.
Great. So we'll have you back on the show when that book comes out.
Thanks so much, Jan.
Yeah, thanks for being with us today.
Okay, bye-bye.
They said some men would be warriors, and some men would be kings, and some men would be owners of land and other man-made things. And false love as the eternal flame would move some doubt thinking rings, and gold would be our power and other fools. Dream of liberty, must not yourselves be fooled. Before you get to plead for freedom, you have agreed to be in rule. If the body stays a shackle, then the mind remains a chain that'll link you to a destiny whereby all good souls are slain. And it won't take long, it won't take too long at all. Say, what does that have to do with me? And I say, you mean not tell me that's all? Of three men in a desert wandering, one is knowing and two are scared. They say time is in the river, but the river is not there. Dying body to will lend themselves to death.
take too long at all. It don't take long. And you may say, I don't know what you're talking about. And I say, you mean to tell me that's all?
Well, that was Farron with It Won't Take Long. Well, it does seem to take a long time, but we're in for the long haul as feminist activists on the struggle for reproductive justice. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. And now we turn things over to Desiree Heligers, who is at the Shell No blockade on July 30th at Portland's Cathedral Park, where she talked with several of the activists about the action and Shell Oil's long history of exploiting indigenous peoples and their lands.
At the end of July, activists converged in Portland from around the region and around the country to protest Shell's plan to drill for oil in the Arctic. For 40 hours, Greenpeace activists dangled from the St. John's Bridge while Kai activists provided important support on the water, impeding the passage of Shell's Fennica icebreaker on its way up to the Arctic. Many who watched the drama unfold and were struck in particular by the heroism and skill of Greenpeace's climbers may well have assumed that the Greenpeace team was composed of privileged white male extreme sports enthusiasts. In fact, the 26-member Greenpeace climbing and anchor support team was surprisingly diverse in terms of both gender, sexual orientation, and ethnicity. At least six of the 26-member team were people of color, and several of the 26 identify as queer. Five of the climbers who rappelled from the bridge were women, and at least three of the 13 climbers were people of color. Two members of the team, Christina Flores and Marty Oronido, spoke in Cathedral Park on July 30th, the day after the showdown with the Fennica. Oronido, a.k.a. Climber Number 2, the founder and director of the Indigenous People's Power Project, linked Shell's Arctic drilling to the long history of exploiting Indigenous lands. Wearing a shirt emblazoned with the word illegal in bold type in a demonstration of solidarity with undocumented people, Oronido spoke of the inspiration he drew during the action from Ogoni writer and activist Ken Sarawiwa. Sarawiwa's outspoken opposition to Shell's exploitation of Ogoni lands in Nigeria culminated in his 1995 execution alongside eight other Ogoni activists. Shell was accused of collaborating with the Nigerian government to execute the men, and following a protracted lawsuit, Shell agreed in 2009 to pay $15.5 million to the families of the murdered activists. This is Greenpeace activist Marty Oronido speaking in Portland's Cathedral Park on July 30th following the July 29th face-off with the Fennica in Portland.
My name is Marty Oronido. I'm Climber 2. It was an amazing privilege to be able to participate in such an action, to be able to do what my heart tells me to do. It's an amazing thing, so I want to thank Greenpeace for that opportunity. From the Muscogee Nation of Oklahoma. My mother is Tana Atham and Ahmel Atham from southern Arizona. And my dad is also Filipino. And I was born and raised in Oakland, California, where I still I was asked to talk about like why I participated in this action. She spoke brilliantly to the love and support of the Portland community, which really did keep us going. If there was people like honking and saying, get a job, hippie, and, you know, get cut down, which there were some of, you know, and God bless them, we're out here for them too, right? You know what I mean? There are generations that are going to come after them. They're going to evolve past that arcane stage of, like, hate and racism. We do this for everybody, you know? But Nancy Hernandez, who's one of my, like, supporters in doing this work in life, but also in, was also on the bridge offering invaluable support to the climbers, reminded us all today during our debrief that it wasn't the police that gave us permission. It wasn't the city that gave us permission to this action. It was the ancestors and the spirits of this place that actually sustained us. I'm the founder and director of an organization called the Indigenous People's Power Project. We call it IP3 for short because that's quite a mouthful to say. And we came up as a project of the Ruckus Society. The Ruckus Society is one of the first places. I went to my first climb training with Nancy at a Ruckus camp in 2000 around the Democratic National Convention that was coming up. And a tremendous organization that's trained hundreds of activists, some many of whom are shared by organizations like Greenpeace, Rainforest Action Network, and a bunch of other phenomenal organizations that do great work. One of the things that was really apparent was that environmental devastation, extraction industries, you name it, oil, gas, coal, uranium, all these things are happening in native country, right? They happen there first, and it's kind of like, that was kind of the setup, right? We're going to give you this reservation, we're going to give you this empty, desolate land where there's a few opportunities, and then, we're going to give you a job, but your job is going to be to extract, valuable resources for world domination from your sacred places, right? From what you hold sacred, which is the one thing you have, is land. And there's been tremendous organizing that's been happening for generations to protect these places, to protect these things, to fight these developments that were brought on during the onslaught of the missionary era, right? The era of termination and relocation that was happening. So a little bit of history. But one of the things that people fought for in the 60s and 70s was to get noticed, one, right? To get a seat at the table, right? And once you got a seat at the table, the idea was is that you would be included in this discussion and your considerations would be incorporated into the discussion whether or not we do these things, right? Whether or not these things are good for people, whether or not we continue to destroy Earth, right, for profit, right? Which is a totally foreign concept. There's no way that any native person will tell you that's a good idea. So once people had a seat at the table, it was still happening, right? So we got the seat at the table, we had the discussion, they did the consult, right? We actually did them a favor by giving them a consultation, and then they just continued to do it, right? And then the only thing standing in its way, the only recourse left, is direct action, right? And civil disobedience. Right. And so for me, I was working with those communities, giving the young people organizer training and giving them some analysis tools, and noticed that their direct action, they hadn't been building up their strength of their direct action capability, right? And so I went back to Ruckus and was like, Ruckus, yo, we need to see this happen in native communities, right? And then it wasn't happening. And then by some strange confluence, there was an opportunity to do the same thing at Ruckus, through Ruckus, in Native communities. And so in that process, I met folks from Alaska, right? I met Faith Gimmel from Red Oil, right? Which stands for Resisting Environmental Destruction on Indigenous Land, right? This amazing organization she's a part of a family that's been fighting, offshore oil and extraction, like, for generations, right? And so her father and my father were friends back in Oakland when he got relocated to Oakland. So that connection, my dad told me, he said, do whatever you can to help, with that in my heart, with the thought of other people that are fighting Shell around the world, right? Fighting Shell around the world with far less resources than what we have, right? Far less, like, quote unquote, freedoms that we have, right? I mean, one of my heroes growing up was that I heard about when I was a young organizer was Ken Sarawiwa, yeah. Right? Woo! Woo! Yeah. So climbing up there was uncomfortable for me. I'm not one of those. I'm not a slim person. I'm not a particularly fit climber. I'm capable, but it was uncomfortable for me. It was hard. It was difficult. If you're not scared, you're probably crazy or stupid. But when I felt like I couldn't continue, I kept thinking about, people in those communities that do so much and put so much on the line. When we have this, fortunate opportunity to actually stand up and do this, with the full capacity of love and compassion, and we think, at times we might think we have it bad, but the type of repression that other folks are feeling around the world and fighting the exact same company that we're talking about, right, are committing the same crimes and outright genocide, violence, murder on behalf of this same company that we're standing against.
That was Greenpeace climber Marty Arenado, who was one of the amazing climbers who rappelled from and suspended themselves from the St. John's Bridge for the shell action at the end of July. He was speaking in Portland's Cathedral Park on July 30th. For those of you who may have missed it, on August 9th, an accident at a shell facility in Deer Park, Texas, resulted in the release of thousands of pounds of toxic gas and raising important questions about the potentially catastrophic effects of its Arctic drilling. This has been Desiree Helligers with the Old Mall Variety Hour.
Tell me why the grass was greener years ago. I swear it used to grow here, but no more here. Tell me why on this hill all the birds they used to come to fly here, come to die here. And tell me why I need to know. Sometimes I wish I didn't have to know. Always show me. Hey, go around for another day or two. Don't give up on me, I won't give up on you. Just believe in me.
That was Hey World, Don't Give Up by Michael Franti. Concluding our program today, Larry Bolden offers his take on the new Nancy Kincaid novel titled Balls. It's about football and women's perspectives on the game.
Good morning. On the jacket of Nancy Kincaid's 1998 novel, Balls, the reader is told the book, quote, should be required reading for any woman who's ever involved with a man who's involved with sports, close quote. And while that claim may be a bit exaggerated, this is an insightful, humorous, and occasionally frightening look at college football. By my count, there are 16 voices, that is, 16 narrators in this book, all women. It is primarily the story of one of these women, Dixie, who at 19 marries an ex-football star who's too small to make it to the pros, but who cannot leave football behind. Instead, he becomes a coach who quite quickly rises to the position of head coach at HAMU. In Alabama, where football is a kind of religion, Coach Gibbs, Mac, begins his college career, his coaching career with a team that wins few games, but due to Mac's ability to recruit players, especially black players, he puts together a solid winning team, and when an old respected coach retires, Mac ascends to the throne with his young wife and two young children in his wake. Each chapter in the book allows a different woman to describe her relationship with football, and either a husband who is obsessed with football or a son who hopes to come to fame and fortune via ball. Quoting from the book, "It was not by accident that God created the world in the shape of a ball. I came to understand that early. All the men in my life imitated God in this way by making small worlds of their own out of balls. As a girl, when I watched the men pass the pigskin, pitch the curveball, perfect the jump shot, I understood that they were playing war. What I didn't understand was that it wasn't just a stupid ball they held in their hands, but the whole world being tossed about from man to man, like a game of keep away from me." Close quote. While Kincaid obviously wants to describe the big business corruption in college football and the toll football takes on the bodies and dreams of the players, she's sympathetic towards not only the mothers of the players and wives of the coaches, but also the players themselves, who see football as their passport to the American dream. Kincaid meticulously chronicles Coach Mac's meteoric rise and sudden fall from grace and the parallel dissolution of the marriage of Dixie and Mac. I loved the stories of the coaches and players, but even more the subtext of the women and children who are essentially orphaned by their men's obsession. Rose, Dixie's mother, is one of the more intriguing voices of the many narrators. She understands long before her daughter does that women and children are secondary to balls and that women who see or know too much are in peril. Quoting again from the book, "Dixie is a pretty girl. I hope it doesn't ruin her life. There are worse things than not getting chosen, like getting chosen too early or getting chosen too often. But you have to live a while before you know that. Dixie's smart, too, which, if she isn't careful, can destroy her about as quick as anything else. I tell her, being smart can be a real detriment to a woman unless she knows how to go about it tactfully. Close quote. There are two other voices that recur throughout the book. Frances Delmer, the wife of an undercoach who never quite makes it to the big time, and Lily, the mother of Jet, who played college ball with Mac and goes on to be a great star in the NFL. Lily has given up on men as husbands or as close friends, but is fiercely protective as a mother. Both of these women provide wonderfully wise and humorous commentary on the toll football takes on the lives of women. Mac is not a bad man, and in fact is honestly dedicated to his players and their welfare. During the football season, he works from early morning till late at night, allowing his wife and children to become afterthoughts. And the off-season, that is the recruiting season, is even worse. He travels around the country wooing players and their parents, his at-home time seeming more like visits than really coming home. Quote, when Mac comes home, he seems delighted to have stumbled upon such a happy household, where everything's clean and pretty, and he's treated as if he were one of the family. We make a home where Mac is a welcome visitor. Drop by any time, we seem to say. Close quote. The story itself is an interesting and complex one, and I don't intend to reveal many of the details. Suffice it to say that the storyline is very similar to Kincaid's own life. Kincaid married at 19, raised two daughters, returned to college as her marriage deteriorated, and after her divorce, remarried the head coach at University of Arizona, so she knows intimately the lives she describes. I first came across Kincaid in a wonderful novel about the South, Crossing Blood, in which she describes the lives of two families living side by side, one black, one white. The novel I'm talking about today shows the same sensitivity towards an understanding of race relations that caught my attention in the earlier novel. While this is not a great book, it is a very good one, and it is indeed, quote, the novel every football widow will want to read, close quote. I've been talking about Nancy Kincaid's novel, Balls. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Well, and that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Jan Hawken with Joe Clement Engineering. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the mole's point of view, that is, from the ground up. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries on social justice, and join us in making mountains out of molehills. Today's program will be podcast on the KBOO website in the next day or two. You can either listen to the entire program or specific segments. You can also find links to more information about guests and topics, as well as past programs. And at 10 this morning, after our show, we'll hear Air Cascadia presenting headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Locus Focus with host Barbara Bernstein. Today's guest is former hedge fund manager Nathan John Higgins, author of the article Energy Credit and the End of Growth. And at 11, Health Watch is off today. Instead, we'll hear Radio EcoShock with host Alex Smith and a program titled It's Wrong to Wreck the World. Thanks so much for being with us today, and stay tuned for Air Cascadia. We'll be right back.
Cascadia. Today is Monday, August 17th, 2015, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. Coming up, we've got 15 minutes of news, comment, and jiggery pokery. Today's guests joining us from the BARC, the Forest Watch Coordinator, Michael Crocter. He will be talking about a recent victory. Don't forget that these things... of course, are celebrated among the community that does, in fact, still care about what's left of our forests. And it reminds everybody that we've got more up ahead, notably, of course, the Elliott State Forest timber. So we're going to sell the whole thing. They're just going to sell it off. This is this in the name of funding schools. You would think that after all this time, somebody would have come up with a better way to fund schools. What are we supposed to tell kids about the forests that used to be there? Oh yeah, we used to have the most extraordinarily beautiful, pristine, old-growth forest. Silence, beauty, staring, you'll lie on your back and stare up at the trees until you become dizzy. Yeah, birds of prey floating up ahead, up above you, moss below, rocks, ferns, all of that gone in the name of so-called education, which